Blog Talk Radio.
Novels and a biography. Three books written by popular and talented storytellers are the focus of tonight's Literary New England radio show. It's Monday, July 27th. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and my guests tonight include Mary Kubica, the super hot best-selling author of The Good Girl that was published last year, and whose latest novel, Pretty Baby, releases into bookstores tomorrow.
Pretty Baby is just one of those books that, it really, I think, it tugs at the heartstrings while simultaneously, you know, your mind is reeling a little bit, wondering what is happening here.
Also here is author and historian Emily Bingham to talk about Irrepressible, the jazz age life of Henrietta Bingham. Henrietta was Emily's great aunt, a woman who ripped through the jazz age like an F. Scott Fitzgerald character, as intoxicated as she was intoxicating. Emily said that when she was a child, there was always an air of mystique when anyone in the family talked about Henrietta.
Every family, I think, probably has somebody who shares the quality that Henrietta had for me growing up, which is you just don't hear much about them.
New York Times bestseller Annie Barrows is also here. Annie's been on tour for her novel, The Truth According to Us, and sadly, New England has not been a stop on that tour.
I have several times suggested that perhaps they would like to send me to New England in October, because, of course, everybody knows that's the most beautiful time to go to New England.
Let's hope Annie's publicists do just what she suggested and sends her to New England in the fall. In the meantime, we can delve into this big, thick, new book of hers, which has gotten just terrific reviews, something that I imagined Annie feeling pretty darn good about.
Well, it's wonderful for me. I mean, it's because, of course, I was kind of anxious about this. This is my first solo effort as an adult author, and though I've written for kids before, and though I was co-author on the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, it is still, stepping through a new threshold to be on my own as an adult author. So it's very exciting whenever I hear that people are liking the book, people who I'm actually not even related to. It's thrilling. It's thrilling.
So tell us what it's about, please.
Well, it's about, it's set in a small town called Macedonia, West Virginia, in the year 1938. And the story begins with Miss Layla Beck, who is a debutante and a socialite and a senator's daughter who lives in Washington, D.C. And through one thing and another, she gets in trouble with her parents. She refuses to marry the man they want her to marry, and she gets kicked out of the house and forced to take a job. The only job that's available to her is a job on the Federal Writers Project, which she's helped into by her uncle, and he assigns her to go to the town of Macedonia, West Virginia, and write the history of that town for their sesquicentennial celebrations. This is something she sees as kind of a death sentence. She thinks she's going to be so bored she's going to die. But once she gets to the town, she ends up boarding with the Romaine family. She takes a room in their house, and there she meets Jotty Romaine, who's an unmarried woman who has lived in Macedonia all her life. And much more importantly to Layla, she meets Jotty's extremely charismatic brother, Felix Romaine. Now, at the same time in the house, there's a 12-year-old, Willa, Felix's daughter, who has just made the discovery that pretty much every 12-year-old makes, which is that grown-ups have been keeping things from her, and she needs to find out everything. And so Willa, for her purposes, starts to dig through the backstory of Macedonia. And Layla, for her purposes, to write this history book, starts to dig through the backstory of Macedonia. And what they both discover independently is that Felix and Jody are at the center of the most hotly contested and sort of mysterious episode in the town's history.
Are you an oral storyteller, or have you practiced that spiel?
I've said it a couple of times, but it does, this whole storytelling gig sort of runs in the family.
Why? Oh, tell me, why?
Well, because, you know, it's not a matter of region, but I do think that everybody in my family who is from West Virginia was a natural-born storyteller. And that is in part what enabled me to pick up the pen and help Marianne finish the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, because I knew Marianne's voice. I knew her stories. And in the same way, my family from which the part of the family that comes from a small town in West Virginia, it was always the part of the family that talked all the time and talked all in stories. So I think that there's a bit of this in my blood. So that may be the explanation for my ability to sum it all up.
Well, you do a heck of a job.
Thank you very
much.
You
must be a lot of fun at readings.
You know, I could read to people all day long. Really, this whole writing gig is started because I love to read to my children. And that's when I became a children's book author, just to sort of indulge that fantasy. And one thing led to another, and now I'm writing big, thick novels.
So, yeah, you know what? This is a really big, thick novel. And one of the things I was thinking is, you know, for a book that is your first foray into writing on your own, you know, you didn't write any little Nancy Pamsy, you know, 150-page novel.
No, I mean, I think every writer, to a certain degree, is writing in order to have something to read. And I wrote the kind of book that I most want to read, which is a big, thick novel. I'm endlessly horrified by short novels. Because I always want more. If I love them, I just want it to go on forever. You know, even A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth, which weighed in at 1,300 pages, when I got to page 1,200, I was filled with dread because it was going to be over, and I loved it so much. So I think I wanted to write a big, thick, heavy novel, and I was only restrained from going completely berserk and writing a 1,000-page novel by my sensible editor, because that's what I love.
So where did this story idea come from, Annie?
Well, I think that it came from a couple of different sources. You know, when Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society came out, there were a lot of people in publishing who tried to figure out what made that story work for everybody. And, you know, many people theorized that that book was so beloved because it was about World War II. And in my head, I kept thinking, it's not beloved because it's about World War II. Part of it. It's interesting because it's about World War II, but what makes people love it is the voice of my Aunt Marianne and the characters. And I began to have this sort of, I guess you would call it, I began to have my hackles raised a little bit, and I thought, you know, you don't need anything but character to make story. And so that was something I was trying to prove to myself, that character is plot, and I do believe that it is. So that was one piece of it. But also, right after Guernsey came out, I went on a sort of a pilgrimage with my mother and my Aunt Marianne's two daughters to the town where my mother and Marianne were raised, in this little tiny town that I had certainly been hearing stories about all my life. And we got to this town, and the town was just absolutely nothing, not remarkable in any way. But I had been trained to see it as the center of the world. The most exciting place that ever existed was this little town. And so when I was there and I was hearing my mom tell stories, but I was seeing something completely bland, I thought about the way that stories make reality and how history is a cultivated and constructed entity. It's not a series of facts. And so the idea of stories making history and the idea of characters making stories those things all combined in my mind, but you know, that alchemy thing happened, and I thought, aha, this is what I want to write about.
And so now, is your town a real place?
Macedonia, West Virginia is not a real place. It's utterly fictional. I deny all relation to reality. No, it is not a real place at all. I made it up, although there are some, it bears some attributes of a couple of towns in West Virginia. And there actually is a town, I found this out later, there is a town called Macedonia, Ohio. And I have never been to Macedonia, Ohio. I know nothing about Macedonia, Ohio. So it's not based on Macedonia, Ohio. I just called it Macedonia because I think it's so funny the way that southern towns are often named after, you know, like Greek battles and famous classical era towns. So that's why I picked Macedonia. I had no idea that there actually was a town called Macedonia.
And you actually have this very delightful article on your website about the truth about 1938 and why you decided to set the novel in that year. Can you explain that?
Well, it was really quite a practical matter, because I needed Miss Layla Beck to have a job, and the only job I could think of that would take her to Macedonia was to write the history of this little town for the Federal Writers Project. Well, there once I had the Federal Writers Project as a necessity, you really don't have very many years on the Federal Writers Project. They started in 36 and it was all over by 1941. So I had to pick one of the years in there, and I landed on 1938 simply because it seemed like the most prolific year for the project. But once I started researching 1938, totally fascinating year, and I actually have ended up knowing far more about 1938 than any human should know. But I, you know, I read Life magazines, I watched movies, I just had the grandest time falling into this year and sort of enveloping myself in the complexities of this year, I could do research forever. It's so wonderful. But I didn't know. I had no idea what kind of a time it was, what kind of an era it was, because for me, it's all about World War II. I'm thinking 1938, everybody's thinking about World War II. But of course, if you lived in America in 1938, you didn't think that was inevitable at all. So it was a fascinating project to pick 1938.
So you've written children's books, you've written adult books. How does someone who goes to school for medieval history become a novelist?
Well, I mean, if you are a medieval history person and you're like me and you studied third century saints, your career options are really limited. I could have become an abbess of a nunnery. That was one option. I could have become an academic. That was another option. I could have tried to go back in time, which I did try, but it didn't work out. So I really couldn't think. There's really nothing you can do with a degree in medieval history. And I didn't really want to become a nun. So I had to think of something else to do. And I was under the completely mistaken impression that if you worked in publishing, you'd get to read a lot. So I thought that I should become an editor, which is what I did at first. I was an editor for many years. And then I realized that writers were having more fun than editors. So I switched over and became a writer and got to, you know, went to the MFA program, and, you know, I'm a certified writer. And then that's how I launched myself into that career.
And have you ever regretted it?
I can't say that I have. I mean, I miss two things about being an editor. I miss being able to dawdle around from cubicle to cubicle and talk to people. You know, when you're a writer, you end up really talking to yourself and your characters, which makes you seem like a crazy person. And you can go stick your head in the refrigerator. But other than that, there's nobody to talk to during the day. And I miss the discussions about art, the discussions about how to make the book what it wants to be. I miss that interplay of ideas where the editor and the writer are working together to make the thing. And now I'm on the other side of it, which is interesting, but it was fascinating to try and get the book to be what it wanted to be. That was both visually and textually.
So you've been on a really nice book tour for The Truth According to Us. Back in May, you were on the East Coast. You were at BookCon and sat on a panel with Vanessa Diffenbach and Paula McLean, which I was at BEA. I was not at BookCon, but I imagine chatting with those two women was just wonderful.
It was great. It was so fun.
Your book tour, you've been other parts of the country, but not back east. Any plan to come to New England or the East Coast again?
It's not on the tour stops I've got ahead of me this time around, but I am hoping that I will come back to New England and to, you know, other parts of the East Coast at some other point. I would love to. I love New England. I'm heading off to Old England tomorrow to do a tour in the UK. And then later on in the summer, I'm off to Australia to do a tour, you know, down there, which is all very thrilling. But I have several times suggested that perhaps they would like to send me to New England in October, because, of course, everybody knows that's the most beautiful time to go to New England. But
so
far,
absolutely.
Yeah, I know. Don't you think that would be good? I think it's just the right time for me to tour New England. But we'll see. We'll see if the publicists agree with me.
And is there something about The Truth According to Us that you hope people experience by reading it?
I hope that people feel when they read it that they are involved, find themselves in a story that they're deeply involved in which there is not a single person who, you know, gets murdered. There is not anybody who ends up in a wood chipper or anything like that. And I don't think that you need the contemporary obsession with various plot elements of like a violent plot element. I don't think you need that to make a fascinating story. This is my contention, that the fascination can come right out of character without the deus ex machina. And I hope that people agree. You know, I hope that readers find my darling people as adorable as I find them.
Well, I think you're adorable, and I've loved talking with you.
Thank you so much,
Annie.
I'm looking at a copy of The Truth According to Us that you can win right now by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Use that same Twitter handle and email address to win Mary Kubica's new novel, Pretty Baby, which goes on sale tomorrow, July 28th. I'm not really sure how, but somehow I missed all the buzz and excitement last year when Mary's debut novel, The Good Girl, was released. And I kind of felt that I needed to admit that to her.
It was my debut book, and I had no idea if anybody would read it, if people would like it. I did not know what I was getting myself into. And as soon as some of those early reviews started to come in, and they were mostly positive, you know, I started to get very excited. I wasn't sure where we were headed with this, but it definitely did get more attention than I was ever expecting it to.
So you became a writer not as a small child, correct? Not as a 19, 20-year-old fresh out of college?
Right. No. I was, you know, I loved writing as a hobby from the time that I was a little girl, but there was also always, you know, a little voice inside my head that didn't think this was something I would ever be able to pursue professionally. And I was really pretty shy about my writing. I kept it to myself. It was one of those things that as a little girl, I would disappear into my bedroom with a notebook or typewriter, and I would work on some story, but I was resistant to sharing it with family or teachers. I just kept that part of myself very secretive. And I went to college and I became a high school history teacher, which was something I loved. But through it all, I still had that passion for writing. And then back almost 10 years ago now, my daughter was born, and I decided that I wanted to stay home and be with her. And it was then that I found that things had really changed. You know, the house was quiet. Although I had an infant at home and I was busy for her, it wasn't like it had been when I was out in the workforce and talking to other adults all day. Things were quiet, and my mind really just started to wander then. And that was when I started to develop the ideas for The Good Girl, and I spent the next 5 years working on it. And I didn't tell anybody other than my husband that I was working on it because, again, this little voice inside my head kept telling me that I was never going to get this book published. But it really didn't matter to me because I was very passionate about the story and I wanted to tell the story even if nobody ever read it. And so I thought through and I really started to kind of fall for my characters and I was thinking about them all the time and I wanted to get their story down on paper. So after 5 years, I finished this novel, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any connections. I didn't have any friends who were authors. I had, other than one creative writing course in college, I had never, I didn't have any education for creative writing. So I just started looking online to kind of figure out what next steps would be, and I wrote up a query letter, and I started sending it off to these agents. Which, you know, in retrospect, nobody had read the book. My husband hadn't even looked at it, you know, to check for typos. My parents had no idea I had even done this, that I had written this book, or that I was contacting agents. So it was really, I don't know, looking back on it, how I was able to pull it off, but somehow I did, and I sent it off to agents, and actually, everybody initially said no. And so I thought, well, you know, that's done. And I kind of tucked that folder away, and I started working on some other manuscripts, nothing that really grabbed me the way that The Good Girl did. And actually 2 years later, so this was 2012, I think now, one of the agents that I had previously submitted to reached back out to me, and she was curious whether or not I had sold my novel or if I was being represented. As it turned out, in those 2 years, she had been promoted from an assistant agent to an agent, and so she was now actively seeking her own clients, and The Good Girl had stuck with her for those 2 years, which just made my day, of course.
Of course. So Pretty Baby clearly didn't take 5 years to write and then 7 years, and then two more years on top of that to get published.
Correct. Right. Absolutely. When I signed the deal for The Good Girl with Mira Books, I actually signed a two-book deal, which at the time, it terrified me a little bit because I only had one book and it had taken me all these years to write it. But on the other hand, it really excited me because here was this opportunity to take what was, you know, a hobby of mine and really turn it into a career. So I took it right away and, you know, knock on wood, the pieces just fell into place with Pretty Baby. It took a little bit of time for me to get the idea, but once I had the idea and I started to understand who these characters were and what motivated them, I was really just kind of off and running. And it's really, I think it was a very special thing, a special connection I had with that book, and I don't know, you know, that I'll get that with other books, or I suppose it'll be hit or miss in the future. But I definitely really connected right away with those characters, and I felt like I understood them. And so the pieces came together quite well for it, I have to say. So it took me about, it was less than a year to get a good, solid draft done and then off to my editor.
So did you do something different during the initial process of writing it that made it come together that much easier?
I didn't, but I will say that I did at that point have an agent and I had an editor, so I had a support network there that I did not have when I was writing The Good Girl. I also was able to really allocate more time in my day to writing. When I was writing The Good Girl, again, it was a hobby, and my main role was being at home and taking care of my children. So writing really kind of fell by the wayside. Sometimes I would have 15 minutes. Some days I might not have any time to write. But with Pretty Baby, now this was my career, and so definitely I had to set aside certain time during the day to write. So it became really a priority, and that helped as well.
So Pretty Baby is released tomorrow, July 28th. Tell us what the story is all about.
Pretty Baby it's set in Chicago, and it's the story of a Chicago mother. She has her own 12-year-old daughter, and she commutes to work every day on the L train. And one day, the weather is pretty nasty. It's raining. It's April. It's chilly. She goes to hop on the L train to go to work, and she comes across this teenage homeless girl who is holding a baby. And she becomes really taken with her. This woman, her name is Heidi Wood. She's one of these women who will just do anything for anybody. And her heart really goes out to this girl and her baby, and she wants to help them. And so against her husband's better wishes, she ends up bringing this girl and her baby into her home. And then we slowly start to unravel who this girl is and how she's come to be here and what effect her being there is going to have on this family's life. And, you know, as with The Good Girl, things are not always what they seem to be.
So where did you get this idea? Were you taking a train, and did you see a girl on the platform?
I did not. No, I am from Chicago, so a lot of the setting really, you know, does come from my own experiences. But in this case, it was a very kind of deliberate thought. You know, I had to turn in a proposal for the second book. And I really, you know, I spent a weekend just going through every possible scenario I could think of and trying to find something that was new and unique and that excited me in the way that The Good Girl had when I was writing. And I was, in all honesty, getting a little frustrated because I wasn't coming up with something. And I was starting to lose a little hope and starting to doubt myself, in all honesty, as a writer. You know, what if I couldn't produce the second book? And I actually remember the moment that I just kind of had this spark of an idea, and it's the moment that that one of the main characters, Heidi, she comes across this homeless girl, and I literally at that moment kind of excused myself from the room, went and got my laptop, and I started writing exactly what I was thinking there, and it actually became the opening chapter of the book, and it stuck. And from there, I was kind of off and running. I wasn't sure where I was going to go with the story. I'm not one of these authors that outlines ahead of time. I just really take it one page at a time. So I wasn't sure how it was all going to play out, but I had a good opening, and that was all I needed at that moment to get started.
Wow. And so if you're not an outliner and you don't already have on paper, you know, the story arc and like your key turning points, does that lead to having to have a lot of revisions at the end, or did it just kind of come out really naturally?
I don't know how, but it pretty much came out naturally. Initially, this was just going to be Heidi and her husband's story, and that's how it starts off. It's kind of a back and forth between Heidi and Chris, and they're each narrating their chapters. And then I started to get the idea that Willow, who is the homeless girl, that she needed to tell her side of the story. So then about maybe 50 pages in, you start to hear from Willow as well, and it really did just come naturally. Of course, there were some instances where I would need to go back and tweak something because the storyline had changed from what I originally thought. But for the most part, it really came out, you know, the first time through. So I was very pleased with that. I'm not saying that will happen in all books. I'm sure that, you know, other books will provide much greater challenges. But for this one, it did, knock on wood, come out pretty naturally.
So are you excited about Pretty Baby's release tomorrow as you were when The Good Girl was about to come out?
I am. I know a little bit more now what to expect with The Good Girl. I had no idea what was going to happen, and I had, you know, never been on book tour before, and the idea of speaking in front of people kind of terrified me. So now things are a little different in that I have a better understanding of what's going to happen, but It's all very exciting. I don't think that excitement would change whether I had written 2 or 20 books.
And you have a lovely book tour set up for Pretty Baby that is going to take you to Texas and Arizona and California and Colorado. You're going to go to Italy, which is absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
Why aren't you coming here to New England?
I don't know. I hope one day in the future to be able to get to New England, but not for the Pretty Baby tour. Maybe when the paperback comes out, I'll be able to head to New England. But I'm sorry to miss that area this time around.
I know. We're sorry to miss you, too. And I know for a fact that you have so many fans on the East Coast. I was at Book Expo America, and I got turned away from your line because there were just so many people. They were sure they were going to run out of books.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
It was so much fun at Book Expo this year. I was there for The Good Girl as well, but being, you know, a brand-new author, not many people had heard of me or had read the book, of course. So this time around, it was so much fun for people to come and get their Pretty Baby galleys, and, you know, a huge chunk of them had already read The Good Girl, and they had so many wonderful things to say. So it's really a thrill to get to talk to readers.
So, Mary, do you think that there is a certain type of Mary Kubica reader?
You know, I don't know. I definitely know that, you know, those that are into the thriller genre are, you know, this obviously seems to resonate with them. But I think that my novels also, they really do verge on women's fiction as well, because they're dealing so much with these issues that women encounter and marital conflict and motherhood and those types of things. So I really do feel that there's quite a broad group of people out there. And, you know, I've heard from both men and women that they enjoyed the books, from really people of many ages. So I definitely think there's a wide readership out there, which has just been wonderful.
And what are you reading right now, Mary?
Right now, I am reading Nicole Bart's The Beautiful Daughters, and it's very good.
And before we wrap things up, do you have a pitch for Pretty Baby, why someone should pick it up as their next read?
You know, Pretty Baby is just one of those books that, you know, it really, I think, it tugs at the heartstrings while simultaneously, you know, you're kind of, your mind is reeling a little bit, wondering what is happening here. I think that the characters are complex and they're multidimensional, and I think that, you know, all of them, really, a reader's heart will go out to. I really hope that people love it, especially those who really love The Good Girl. I hope that they love Pretty Baby as much.
Mary, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a thrill.
If you haven't already reached out to us via email or Twitter to win Mary Kubica's Pretty Baby or Annie Barrow's The Truth, According to Us, you can do that now, as we also give away a copy of Emily Bingham's Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. Irrepressible is a biography about Emily's great aunt, a woman raised like a princess in one of the most powerful families in the South, but whose love affairs, breakdowns, anxieties, and actions led to her becoming a source of embarrassment for her family, people who labeled her as a $3 bill.
This is, the title is Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. And Henrietta Bingham was my grandfather's older sister, but by the time I came along in the 1960s and 70s, she had been reduced in terms of conversation that I heard to a picture of a horse barn that hung on a wall that apparently they said was a wonderful barn that had belonged to her. And that seems odd. But then a very brief story that my father would tell if her name came up, which was that she would steal the bacon out of your BLT when you looked away. You know, I think like most of us, we're very susceptible to suggestion of our, you know, loved ones and elders. And I just, you know, bought pretty much hook, line, and sinker that this was a, you know, person who, for whatever reason, just wasn't very interesting or important, and because she was so not talked about and dismissed. And so even though I was a very nosy little kid, I never did look into two trunks that were in my own family's attic and contained clothes and belongings of hers from the 1930s. And it wasn't until a long time, even into my own interest in her, that I actually, you know, was able to plumb things that were, you know, I slept under that room almost all my childhood. So it just, I guess I want to say that every family, I think, probably has somebody who shares the quality that Henrietta had for me growing up, which is you just don't hear much about them. And there are lots of reasons that can be, but in her case, it turned out there was quite a story there.
And in a nutshell, I know it's a complex story, but in a nutshell, can you explain it?
So Henrietta was born in 1901. In Kentucky. Father was at the time an ambitious lawyer and politician, but he, during her childhood, he became a newspaper publisher. Anyway, she grows up and catches really the wave of the Jazz Age at the almost perfect time. So as a teenager and a young woman in her 20s, she was right at the center of that explosion of both, you know, culture and music, and also changing morals and mores around sexuality and freedom of women to explore more aspects of life. So she was very privileged, and she, from an early age, displayed a lot of physical and just sort of qualities around her ability to attract people's love and interest, and that went to both sexes. So even a woman who had grown up with her as a girl in Louisville, Kentucky later, she liked girls and I liked boys. And that was the big difference between them. That was in some ways quite a, well, she picked a good time to grow up, because in the early 20s, there was more tolerance for the kind of sexual experimentation she was interested in than
really
times in the future. And so, you know, things don't progress, even though we've seen such immense change and, you know, I believe great progressive change in the last 30 years. The story of sexuality in the 20th century is not one of steady opening. It's rather one of a burst of openness that then shut down in the 30s, later 30s, 40s, 50s, and early 60s, and then began opening up again in the late 60s and 70s, and, you know, led to the movement we're familiar with in our lifetimes. So in some ways, her story, she was very courageous about following the course of her own desires, and that took her everywhere, you know, from into college at Smith College, where she seduced her freshman composition professor.
Good for her.
Who then took her to England on sabbatical and signed Henrietta up for psychoanalysis because, well, even though she adored Henrietta and never did want to break relations with her, she said in a letter, this is the professor, that it simply wasn't a way to go through life. And that was true. I mean, it wasn't like you could just express homosexual relationships openly and expect no consequences. There would be. But I guess what I'm trying to say about the 20s is that about it openly, very much at all, there was a kind of, oh, let's just not, you know, let's, you know, when you think about the blues singers like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, who were able, you know, who did incorporate lesbian themes into some of their lyrics. And it was, you know, something you had to be careful, but you could do it. You could just slip by.
So I know that you have a bachelor's degree in history from Harvard. You went on to get your PhD at the University of North Carolina. You must have always been, I'm guessing that you must have always been something of a snooper, right? Most people that I know who are interested in history, you know, have a guilty past of snooping through drawers and diaries and things like that. It seems like at least from what you've told me, that it took you such a long time to finally open those trunks.
It really did. And one of the really pivotal moments for me as an historian with this and a family member was when I took it upon myself to do an oral history with my grandmother. Again, something I would encourage anybody to do with family members, parents, grandparents, great aunts, uncles, all of that, cousins. Because it was during a long interview where she was speaking to me about her own life, but mentioning her sister-in-law, and she said not only was this woman intimidating to her because she had been running with this sophisticated Bloomsbury crowd in England, but this is in the sort of later 1920s that she met Henrietta, and that she was so beautiful and, you know, just, you know, a fabulous presence, but also that she finished those references by saying, well, but you know, Emily, she was an invert. And I just, you know, this word, I was in my mid-20s at this point, I thought I knew this had something to do with sexuality. The way she said it was sort of ugly, and I I had to just leave it there. The word hung with me, and later when I was transcribing the oral history, it was like a little thorn. It bothered me. I ended up looking it up, and it became, I realized it was a pre-Freudian term for someone attracted to members of their own sex. And it made me angry a little bit that this had been, you know, a label that had that just ugly sound, you know? And so I began to, you know, I thought, well, here is this woman who spent time with Virginia Woolf's circle, and I later learned actually had various members of that very interesting group of intellectuals in England fall in love with her. And my research found that she actually was, I mean, a huge figure, a sort of American phenomenon, it girl in London in the early 20s for these folks. But at the time, it just seemed like this sort of sad label. And I thought, well, I love this name. It's a great, strong-sounding woman's name. And why don't we give it to our daughter, Henrietta, who became my Henrietta, who's now 16. And it was really that decision to name a child that I think is why this book came about, because it was the fact that this name was again on the lips of people, that stories and archival material and objects, I mean, everything from linen sheets to letters to old beautiful cigarette cases with diamond encrusted edging, you know, came to me. And that gave me the motivation to start looking at the archives.
I love that story, and what an incredible gift to your daughter as well to now have the story of her namesake.
Yeah, and she is, you know, she is very handling that beautifully. But, you know, I also feel like I have an 11-year-old son and a 20-year-old son, and, you know, Henrietta, for all her courageousness and all her flaws, because she, you know, wasn't all dancing the black bottom and, you know, mixing great cocktails. She had a lot of inner demons, and those inner demons pursued her through her life to 1968 when she died, 1 year before Stonewall, right? She was living in New York by that time. But she, her legacy and the what we have learned and anyone can learn from her life is something that my sons are just as affected by as my daughter. And my youngest was, we were on the way to a book signing, and he said, well, what are you going to say, Mama? And I said, well, I'm going to tell a story. And he said, tell me the story. And I said, but you'll hear the story. And he said, well, tell me another story. I want to hear all the Henrietta stories.
Aww.
So like these, you know, that is a gift that, you know, I feel like getting to write Henrietta's story and the people who loved her and the people who never could forget her, she's just having this newly, a second coming out party, I like to say, and I think it's a better one than the first.
Definitely. And now, this is not your first book, but I think it's fair to say that it's certainly your most personal book.
Yes, yes. My earlier work was derived from my dissertation, but it's not a wholly academic book. It's called Mordecai, an Early American Family, and it traces the course, the evolution of a extended Jewish family from the Revolutionary through the Civil War period, and the way they're becoming American and their success as middle class Americans in the South can tell the story of Jews in America, and also the struggles with assimilation that Jews had in this country. And so I do see one strong similarity between the two works, and that is that they both take a biographical perspective on people who are not known. They don't have, you know, nobody has been waiting for a book about Henrietta Bingham or for the Mordecai family, but they are able to bring to light people who are, you know, just regular people out there, more or less, whose stories really do carry a wonderful part of American history. And I want my readers to think about how their own lives or the people they know or their families are carrying those stories as well.
And, you know, authors generally have some kind of nerves and trepidation when they're at the time their book is being published. Do you think that you might have had a little more of that just because the subject was so close to you?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there's always a lot of, well, for me, I did not want to write a book about my family. And it was the years of people bringing these offerings of what I call Henrietiana to me that made, I finally just sort of felt like, uncle, girl, you want someone to understand you, and I'm going to try to do it. When I took that on, I persuaded myself, let's put it this way, that Henrietta's story, because she had been so marginalized in my family, would not particularly overlap with other aspects of my own family's history. And we owned newspapers and other media properties in Kentucky for 4 generations, and those were sold in the 1980s when I was in college. And it was a big, not particularly pleasant family breakup, really, over that decision. And so, you know, I had always said I wanted to stay clear of that. There were still a lot of raw feelings, and, you know, why dig that up? Other books had been written in the meantime about it. And so it was actually one of the big surprises to me was that in delving into the story of this outsider in the family, I came to understand how the main story of my family that I had received was really quite different than I expected. And one aspect of that was that Henrietta's father, the publisher, had identified her, not my grandfather, as his successor, and really offered that role of being a major leader in the journalism world to this woman in the 1920s, which would have put her 50 years ahead of Kay Graham.
Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah, and the reasons that she didn't pick up on that offer are embedded in the book and in the complexity of the family story.
And Emily, we need to wrap things up, but why should someone perhaps consider picking up your book?
Well, I think it's there is a hauntingness of a person whose life had such verve, such capacity to affect others. I mean, she was legendarily seductive. And so there's a lot of great juiciness in there around somebody who has that power. But we all know people who have that kind of allure and who are so irresistible. And I think this book, in a way, while it takes you through the Jazz Age and through a great family story and through World War II and amazing relationships she had with people you do want to know about, tennis champions, the Prince of Wales, wonderful artists like Dora Carrington. But in the end, she was just a person trying to get through, and she was carrying burdens like anyone else. And so I guess I think people can identify with her, whether you're gay or straight. There's a really rich vein of someone who got pushed away for reasons that we understand, but it's a humanistic story because all of us are trying to understand that not fitting in does not mean you deserve to be forgotten.
Emily, that's awesome. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Great to talk with you too, Cindy. Thank you.
Was Emily not fabulous? and smart and so interesting to listen to. It's not too late to win a copy of Irrepressible, The Jazz Age of Henrietta Bingham, or any of the books we featured tonight. As I'm sure you know, our Twitter handle is @LitNewEngland and our email address, LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Also, if you missed any part of tonight's show, in just a few minutes, the entire episode will be available in the Literary New England Archives, along with all the shows we've aired since our very first one in December 2011. Thanks so much to my three terrific guests tonight, Mary Kubica, Annie Barrows, and Emily Bingham. Thanks also to you for listening. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back next week with more author interviews and book giveaways. I hope you'll be back too. Until then, I wish you a great week and great reading.